Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. Hey, this is Kat, Communications Director of HRN, here with a preview of Episode 2 of Meat and 3. This week, we're talking pork. We'll learn the best way to make a BLT.
I don't think I've ever successfully made a BLT just because I eat the bacon before any other part.
How pitmasters and restaurateurs are helping put small-scale pig farmers back to work in Alabama.
It's all about money. That's the bottom line.
What pork has to do with economics?
Farmers could be particularly affected by China's threat to levy its own tariffs on pork and soybeans.
And with government.
Basically, all of politics is pork at this point.
So tune in on Friday afternoon for your weekly serving of Meat and Three. And make sure you subscribe to be the first to know when new episodes air.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back to the main course, OG. The main course was the first show on the Heritage Radio Network, and the main course, OG. OG, Vitor, give me some of that scratching, will you? There you go. OG. Anyway, we continue in the tradition of the main course, and today we're going to drop a truth bomb on you all. I'm Mike Edison. Patrick Martins is on assignment, and we've got a great panel of brilliant women today, but none more so than our moderator, Libby Greeley.
Thank you, Mike. So as you said, in the studio today, we have Mike Edison, the writer extraordinaire, Catherine Greeley, VP of Heritage Foods.
Hey there.
Emily Pearson, Director of Wholesale at Heritage Foods.
Hello.
And myself, Elizabeth Greeley.
AKA Libby.
We are very excited for the show today, and we have some great segments. The Weekly Based is where we talk about current food news and get the opinion of our panel. We did not share the exact details of questions, so the panel will be improvising for the most part, really off the cuff, seeing what they think about these topics of food news, followed by our segment, Words to Marinate On. We listen to a segment, little clip, and give our thoughts on it. The Mylard Reaction is where we ask a question to our panelists. And the Weekly Grill is where we ask some questions of our weekly guest. And we have a great guest coming up later in the show. And for those who listened last week, we have one update. We had talked about the Farm Bill that was being debated last Friday, and it did not pass. So that's great news, and it's very interesting. And we'll keep following that on the show and see how that develops. But we'll jump right in now.
I think it's because we were obviously against it. They must have heard us.
Exactly. It was, yep. Exactly.
I figured.
And now we'll jump right into our segment, The Weekly Based. So the first article that really stood out to me, and I wanted to choose this for the panelists, because I think consumer trust of large companies is very low right now. And in this case, consumers are getting hurt. So from the New Food Economy, the Bumblebee CEO has been indicted in a tuna price-fixing conspiracy. Bumblebee, Starkist, and TriUnion, who owns Chicken of the Sea, allegedly conspired to keep prices of other white fish artificially high, and the Department of Justice is holding them responsible for these actions. These are the most significant criminal charges thus far for Bumblebee's CEO, Christopher Lechuski, for participating in a conspiracy to fix prices on packaged seafood sold in the United States. Bumblebee itself pleaded guilty to one count of felony price fixing and agreed to pay a $25 million fine for its role. But for a company worth $1 billion, a fine like this is less substantial. The Lechuski's indictment, where he could face up to 10 years in prison and $1 million fine, sends a more powerful message. So I thought this was really an interesting article, and I would love to hear what you think of this. What about you, Emily?
All I was going to say is I was raised as a tuna fish kid. And, like, I don't know. I'm a little upset about this. I think I'm going to have to explore the world of PB&J. But my family and our household, we were all about tuna fish. So now I think I'm going to have to boycott.
Well, I think it's interesting. This happened with chicken as well, something that's very close to our hearts. You know, some big chicken companies were price fixing. So it's not just tuna.
But all right. I'm a little scarred. PB&J for now.
What about you, Catherine?
Well, yeah, it's definitely, like you point out, hurting the consumer. And I think it's another great reason, you know, to think about supporting smaller businesses, businesses that aren't publicly traded, and this idea of knowing your farmer whenever you can, or your producer, and being able to, you know, have that conversation and trace your food back. And then in this case, because it seems like it's happening a lot with protein, it is something that maybe you can, you know, scale back on a little bit and explore other options.
Hey, collusion is the word of the day. This is like that's the truth bomb, yo. All right. No, this is Tunagate. This is like, you know, like Patrick always says, you should never buy food from a company that is publicly traded because it's all about the bottom line. And we've seen this before in other industries, automakers colluding to keep their prices even. And in the NFL, you know, our lords and masters, you know, colluding really to keep Colin Kaepernick off the field, even though he's a highly qualified player, but someone doesn't like his politics. This is very common in big industry. You know, the people that you think are actually in competition are actually working together against the common good.
Yeah, and ultimately, consumers are the ones paying, and the big corporations are profiting.
You don't matter.
Me personally, Mike?
Well, that's the message. You know, it's all going to the bottom line. You know, and at what cost?
Exactly. So we have a really relevant article, especially right now with all the news of water shortages, not only in the U.S. but around the world. And current administration trend of moving away from environmental protection legislation. And there are real consequences to algal blooms, which are chemical runoffs from farms that create green blankets on lakes. From New Food Economy, we get the problem of algal blooms. These blooms have tripled in number. In 2016, we had 51 algal blooms were spotted in lakes across the United States, and in 2017, that number has more than tripled to 169. These blooms continue to wreak havoc in the country's waterways, killing fish and threatening the health of people and their pets. The pollution that causes them comes from a variety of sources. There's a pretty strong consensus that the blooms are primarily the result of runoff from nearby farms, and there's no easy way to connect the chemicals from where they come from, so no one is being held accountable. Some blame the agricultural lobby for the state's lack of progress on farm pollution control, and some states have taken measures into their own hands to regulate, requiring farms near public waterways to plant vegetation buffers between farm fields and water bodies to reduce the runoff. But is enough being done? It's a great question. Mike, would you like to start?
Okay, you call it an algal bloom. Okay, get ready with the bomb, Vitor. I call it slime. All right? Okay, it's disgusting. And this is just, you know, one more thing. Here's the question. When did clean air become liberal issues? Okay, this shouldn't even be a thing. The EPA and the idiot Scott Pruitt is running the thing. It is so beyond corrupt the way they're dismantling it. And again, who's paying the ultimate price? The corporations are winning and the people are losing. It's disgusting. Really, it's completely immoral, and clean water should be a priority. You know, period. You know, full stop. I mean, this is absolutely inexcusable. This is the kind of thing we need to be watching. I've said it many times before, we've spoiled our nest. Our time here on this planet is doomed.
Mike, you are dropping two bombs.
You know, it is always terrible to hear these stories, and it reminds me, because at Heritage Foods, people often ask us, you know, this system that you've created of, you know, these small farms, animals on pasture, but can it feed the world? And, you know, stories like this remind me that we aren't currently feeding the world with the system we're in, and we're polluting it, which is even worse. You know, so it just makes you consider the system that we have. And like Mike says, it's completely backwards.
Emily?
I We were just traveling to visit a couple farms, and throughout the state of Missouri, you know, not specifically on the land of our farmers, but driving around, we did see some of these lakes with this, you know, kind of, as Mike called it, slime. And I think, you know, a lot of us just think like, oh, is that natural? Like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I'm supposed to make of it. I think hearing about this will make me far more aware. But just that, you know, what can we do to avoid this? And, you know, things that might appear natural aren't always. So
yeah, and the question is, should states be regulating this? Should this be a federal regulation? Should we be really incentivizing farmers to plant this vegetation? How can we make some changes?
This needs to come from the top down. This needs to be on the federal level, because when you see states do it, they do it to line the pockets of their local industries, and the pork industry is enormous. There's no way you're going to fight them in Iowa and in the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. Clean water, clean air, this needs to come from the top down.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, our next article is right off of that. So last week we talked about this article from North Carolina and pig farmers, and this one really builds off of it. As lawsuits keep coming up, it is interesting to see if they will have an impact on factory farms and the way that they operate. There's also pushback from legislators to cap how much these companies will have to pay, a lot or a little. So we had talked about North Carolina, this lawsuit that came out against pig farmers last week, and now we're seeing in Iowa, plaintiffs are suing factory farms and trying to, you know, hold them accountable for the pollution and how they are impacting their lives. So Civil Eats covered this article, and factory farms use pig lagoons to collect the animal waste under them and use giant fans to blow the air out of the buildings. The air and the waste particles are carried and blown into nearby communities, putting chemicals into the air, and the plaintiffs in Iowa said that they have to deal with unpleasant and unhealthy ills, including sickening stenches, mists of wastewater drifting onto their properties, swarms of flies, and roadside dead boxes containing pig carcasses, all of which cause chronic illnesses, lower property value, and decrease their quality of life and lead to discomfort, anger, embarrassment, and fear. So as we see more of these lawsuits coming up against factory farming and big ag, I really want to ask you guys, like, where do you see the future of this going? Do you think this will have an impact, or, you know, this is just, we're going to see a few of these and it's going to kind of die out?
I think it's a really tough question. I mean, I think that, if people can afford to pay the fines, they're just going to keep doing it. You know, nothing is going to change, especially if their meat is being imported to places like China and larger companies are footing the bill. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's great that it's continuing to happen in many states, because this is something on a state level. And the more we see it, I think the more the consumer is aware. But at the end of the day, this doesn't have to be how pigs are raised. You know, we see that with our own farmers. You know, you only raise as much as your land can allow so that they are pasture raised and they're living outside. You know, at Heritage Foods, we work with farmers that, you know, are only raising their pigs on pasture. And so they poop and it becomes part of the healthy, natural part of the land. It's not going into a lagoon that turns, you know, Pepto-Bismol pink. But I do think that it happening in many states, you know, it's definitely raising awareness. And I'm glad that people are fighting back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but big ag and industrial farming, I mean, those are the guys that are paying the politicians. You know, it's very hard for these cats who want to stay in office because they think they've got some, you know, sort of entitlement to take the money and pass these laws for their buddies, you know, to allow pig shit in the rivers. You've heard me say it before. Anybody who pollutes a river or water, anybody who pollutes the earth should be in jail, period. It's sedition, okay? It's really just it's everything, you know, we've ever been taught is like, you know, you keep, you know, your pen clean. It's so terrible. And dead boxes? I mean, how could anyone even say that with a straight fucking face? It's completely out of control. And it's my man Vitor, yo. I mean, it really, really is crazy when you think about it, and then you say, okay, well, you know, a $25 million fine is just the cost of doing business. It needs to be higher. It needs to be absolutely prohibitive. It cannot just be factored in, you know, to a normal day's business that we're going to dump pig poop in the river, you know? And unfortunately, you know, with the monkey that's running the country, you know, and the, you know, baboons that he's hired, especially the guy running the EPA, who's dismantling it, you know, it's going to be a long time before we can get back to where, you know, where it should be. We've created a lot of damage. And unfortunately, dirty water is the new normal.
Yeah. Anything to add, Catherine?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it needs to come from the top down, but the systems, you know, definitely need to change.
Yeah. And this last article from Civil Eats is really interesting. It's a different way of using tech in agriculture. So this startup, Appeal Sciences, is a company that is working on an all-natural, virtually invisible coating that could extend the life of foods before they spoil. Appeal has found ways to coat a wide variety of fruits and vegetables to delay ripening and prevent spoilage caused by various pests. The coatings are non-toxic, and they promise to deliver better fruit with less refrigeration and spoilage. But coaxing growers in the United States to use them has been hard. The peels are not certified organic, but rather approved for use on certified organic products. It was developed with the intention of helping farmers in Africa who do not have easy ways to transport their product and keep it cold to keep it from spoiling. And currently about half of the produce goes bad before it gets bought or where it needs to be. That is really interesting. I have mixed feelings about myself, but let's hear what you think, Kath.
Sure. Yeah, I think it definitely brought up a few questions as you're reading this. But on a positive note, it did make me think. My husband's actually a chocolate maker and visits cacao farms pretty often. He's been doing it for years and always comes back home and tells me about this amazing cacao fruit that he eats. And he'd love for me to try it. I always ask him if he can bring me some back. And he's like, no, by the time I'd get it here, it would be rotten and smelly and nothing that you'd want to eat. So it is interesting to think that there are, probably so many of these foods that we've never tried before. And this could be a way to make more foods accessible.
She's totally positive about it. I'm like 50-50. I mean, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think there definitely are benefits of it. I think also if you're looking at, third world countries or that you cited that it's something that they might put in place in Africa. I think to extend the life of a limited amount of produce and of, healthier food sources. My only question is, already people here in the U.S. at least have a lot of trouble with the idea that their fruit and vegetables are traveling, apples or pears are picked from the trees before they're ripe, or watermelons, they're traveling on a truck across the country. Already we're trying to encourage people to, buy local or buy from, farmers that are, growing it in a locally, for lack of a better term, and knowing your farmer. And so the idea is that would that hurt that ability to shop at the farmer's market, to go and buy your fruit once a week, would we be instead turning to buying things every 3 weeks? So I guess just thinking about that. But I think to have experiences and what it could do for low-income areas would be great.
All right. I think we already have this coating. It's called a candy apple, okay? or a caramel apple. What you do is you take the F train all the way to the end. It's called Coney Island, and they have lots of them there. Some of them even have that coconut, that shaved coconut on them, and they're delicious. I highly recommend them. Listen, seriously, every time someone tells me something is imperceptible and non-toxic, it's like, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, I've just seen too much bullshit in my life, heard too much nonsense about this, and I get your point about especially in third world countries, and some of this produce and making sure that it lasts longer. But also what we've been taught, what we've learned, and what we preach, really, in part of the sustainable food movement, is that the food that travels less is definitely better for everyone involved. And you're talking about vegetables coming on trucks. What about on giant boats from halfway around the world? And we definitely should be eating more locally, especially, produce. These things shouldn't be burning a hole in the environment, just to get some fresh produce. And I mean, I suppose if it's cacao you want, that's a nice exotic thing. But here in New York, maybe you got to go to Africa to get one.
Yeah. Sure. No, but I do think it could help, lower income communities or areas of the world that can't get nutrients.
I think it's a really interesting topic and we're split on it. And I will continue to follow up and find articles to keep this in our...
Can we sample some? Like one apple?
Obviously, I'm all for any sort of food technology that helps feed the world, especially impoverished nations and underserved communities. But I'm just highly suspect when the words food and technology are mentioned in the same breath.
All right. No, that was great, guys. Thank you. We're going to take a short break. Take it away, Vitor.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
All right, we are back here on the main course. OG, yo. There you go. That's Vitor on the knobs. I'm Mike Edison. Patrick Martins is out on assignment, allegedly, playing hooky more likely. I'm here with an incredible panel featuring Catherine Greeley and Emily Pearson, and the moderator with the most, Elizabeth Greeley.
Thank you, Mike. Now we're moving on to our next segment, Words to Marinate On. We have a great clip to listen to from our poultry farmer, Frank Reese. Roll the tape, Vitor.
Those different color patterns, near bands of white hollow and black slate, happen naturally, even in the wild. So when those mutations would happen, the farmers would get excited and say, well, we're going to keep back all those near bands, so we're going to keep back those whites that are showing up, and we're going to breed specifically for that. So that's, they are not different breeds. They're different color variations. The best way I can explain, you can buy a poodle. You can get a chocolate poodle and a brown poodle and a white poodle and a spotted poodle. They're all poodles. What makes them standard bred or heritage is not the color of the feathers. It's their conformation, how they're built, how they stand, how they grow, that they do stop growing, that they haven't been mutated. The toms get up to 36, 40 pounds and they stop. They can still naturally mate. And if you don't kill them, they'll live for 15 years, you know? The hens still have the ability to lay eggs and sit on them and hatch them. The hens still have the ability to raise their babies. That's the difference. It, you know, people really get wrapped up in the color and so on, and that has nothing to do with it. It's what we have done, man has done to them.
That's a very interesting clip from Frank, who has some feelings about that. All right, Catherine's going to start it off.
Yeah, I do think this is an interesting clip from Frank, especially because at Heritage, oftentimes, you know, we're kind of saying the opposite. We're talking about different breeds of pork and different breeds of lamb that have different appearances, different characteristics, and different flavors to the meat. But Frank is saying here that it's really different varieties of the same turkey. So the flavor differences between the heritage varieties are not so different, but when you take that turkey and compare it to a commercially raised turkey, a broad-breasted white, you're going to get completely different experiences. It's definitely something that's a little difficult to wrap your head around, but it makes sense. I think Frank explained it really nicely right here.
Yeah, any thoughts on that, Mike?
With the poultry, I think it's a lot different than the pork. I think you're right. I mean, if you buy a heritage turkey, it tastes like something that was like grown on earth. If you're buying something that, God forbid, you know, and please don't ever do this, that says Smithfield or Purdue on it, you know, and has been raised in the worst conditions, it's awful. I mean, you compare the two, it's just like this mealy, it's barely even meat, and the chicken, oh my God, like a Purdue chicken, it's disgusting. Even my cat won't eat that anymore since I started bringing, you know. I mean, seriously, it's like my cat's like demands, you know, natural pasture-raised chicken because it's disgusting when you've had the alternative. I mean, I haven't eaten KFC in like many, many, many years. I mean, it's so gross once you've had a real bird that was like raised under like normal conditions, you know, to ever go back.
Mike, you're trying to tell us that you shop at Heritage. Online at heritageFoods.com for your cat.
Exclusively for my cat.
So we think we're selling to you, but really it's you're bringing it home to your cat. We're honored. It's for everybody. Your cat should know the difference.
No, the cat, and why should my, you know, to suggest that my cat should eat anything less than the best food is classist at worst and racist at best. It's a terrible thing. But I'll tell you what, with the pork chops especially, there is definitely a pronounced difference between, say, the red wattle, you know, which is porkier, and I like it. And then on the Berkshire, which I'm starting to move towards a little more, it's a little creamier. The texture is a little bit different. They totally cook a little bit differently. The heritage breeds, they are, it's true, they are very different from breed to breed.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, that's, as Catherine was saying at Heritage, part of the reason we don't sell our turkeys breed specific, just for the reason that, you know, Frank is talking about. At the end of the day, they all do taste the same. They just have a different appearance on the outside. So while they're alive and living in Kansas on his farm and we go to visit and they're beautiful and picturesque, we get to know, you know, each of the different Heritage breeds. But at the end of the day, it's really about the difference between Heritage and something that's commercially raised. And
the lamb also, some of the lamb breeds definitely have a much stronger presence than the others. And for people who love lamb, I mean, I think it's very important to try them and check it out and sort of land on, you know, on what you like. It's no different than anything else in life. I mean, life is about making good choices, right?
Exactly. I loved how he brought up the comparison as different breeds of dogs. I once tried to use that to explain to someone, and he was just like, no, I don't want to think about that. And I was like,
you got to know your audience.
You have to know the different breeds. Exactly. Any last comments? It looked like you were going to say something, Mike, but you're...
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, tucking into a poodle, and the answer is no. No matter how delicious you tell me it is, Libby, it's not happening.
Okay,
and stay the hell away from my cat.
All right, moving on to the next segment, the Mylard reaction. So it's Heritage Breed Week. Did everyone know that?
Yes.
We've been following the Livestock Conservancy, and they're listing their most endangered breeds up there. We sell some of them. It's great to see them in the pictures. But as we think about that, what does the word rare mean to all of you? I would love to hear that. Do you want to start, Emily?
Sure. I think before coming to Heritage Foods, rare probably had a more mainstream connotation to me. Now, you know, I definitely think about it in association with the heritage breeds that we sell. And rare is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's, you know, preserving livestock that are on the brink of extinction. And we say we have to eat them to save them. So these are the less common, you know, they're harder to come by, but there are farmers who are choosing to raise these rarer breeds. So for me, I definitely think about it in the context of heritage. Of course, I'm biased, but, you know, that's where my head's at.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think they, you know, the interesting thing, too, is that they have, you know, rare, to me, kind of means this diversity, because it's these breeds that have really storied histories, you know, different biologies, slightly different, and different, you know, gastronomic applications and flavors. So it really, you know, on some levels, it seems like it's more just a sort of a foodie thing, but really, in actuality, it's so much more than that. It's about history, but it's also this, you know, the science piece is so important, and it's really important to preserve these animals.
That's right. It's about biodiversity, and it's about these rare breeds, tracing it back, tracing their genetics back, you know, 2,000 years, 6,000 years. Some of these breeds were spoken about, you know, in the Bible, which is incredible, before they got frankenfooded into these, you know, giant-breasted turkeys that just collapse because they, you know, they grow so fast they can't even support themselves, and these chickens that are, like, dying from the second, you know, they're born. It's disgusting. So a rare breed is, you know, it's important that people are educated about that, and it's not, and there are plenty of them, and they need to be taken off the list. They need to be raised more often. They're healthier, they're better. Of course, the problem is that, you know, the truth is, like, when you buy a heritage turkey, it seems, you know, pricey. It is expensive, but that's like the real cost of actually raising that turkey versus $1.99 a pound Thanksgiving turkey. And it's not probably possible to raise 17 million turkeys and keep the price so low, and these rare breeds are being extinguished because of that.
Something kind of cool, too, is if you guys are interested in learning more, you can go on the Livestock Conservancy's website, and they do have a list of the sort of critical status. So whether they're, you know, on the brink of extinction, if they're on the critical list, if they're just considered rare, you know, Berkshire pork has really moved into a... It's not as high on the risk chart. You know, it's a much more widespread thing now. So, which is in thanks to people being educated and people choosing to ask for and request Berkshire pork.
And chefs love the Berkshire pork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No, definitely. So no one just thought rare was like with their burger or their steak, how they wanted it cooked?
Didn't well, cross my mind.
Listen, it's a loaded These question. This is, you know, everybody here is drinking the Kool-Aid just a little bit. You know,
exactly.
I mean, on another note, you know, that radio is called a medium because it's rarely well done.
Oh.
Well, you guys are killing it. Thanks for the bomb, Victor.
And now time for our last segment, the weekly grill. So we're getting our guest who's calling in today. So Vitor, let me know when he's on the line.
Morning.
Hi. So welcome back. Hi. This is our guest, Larry Bucal, who has run Cannonball Express, a less-than-load trucking company based out of Omaha, Nebraska, for decades. And he has been a guest many times. So thank you so much for being on with us today, Larry.
Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you have such a pivotal role. As we love to say, we say, look around you and try to find something, anything, in the room you are that you can see that has not been on a truck before. And it's really amazing. You can really stump people with that question. So the work right. you're doing is pivotal. And I know, you know, you've known Patrick for a long time and he was sad to not be here, but we're very happy to have you.
Thank you.
So we have a few questions to learn more about the trucking industry. So last Alrighty. Year, the Department of Transportation implemented new rules involving ELDs. What are ELDs and what are the effects of ELDs in the national trucking scene?
Well, briefly, ELD stands for electronic logging devices. What it is a computer that's in every truck that basically monitors your drive time, your sleep time, your on-duty time, and your off-duty time. It's important to understand that no rules have changed, but what has changed is now instead of doing it manually, it's all done electronically. So what it does for the truck, it doesn't require the driver to think as much about how many hours he can work until he has to sleep and how much more driving time he has. The computer generates all that data and provides it to the driver immediately so he knows what his workday is going to involve. So it's actually a positive thing in the way of helping the driver understand, based on the rules of the road set by the federal government, how much time that he can continue to drive, work, and then when his requirements are to park the tractor and take his sleep or berth or go off duty. So it's become a great tool to help eliminate any kind of violations that somebody might make a mistake and drive a little longer than necessary. The electronics now are in the trucks, and it does all the thinking in the way of doing it safely and within the rules of the road. So there isn't any interruption or violations that could occur to the driver. So in all, it's a positive. But it is an expense that was added. It took effect basically last December 18th. And it does affect the driver's ability to maneuver in certain respects and has changed the way that they've thought about what they can do and what they can't do. And I can elaborate on that a little later here.
Okay. Yeah, that's very interesting. And so what are rates at this time, and what is the impact consumers will see?
Okay, well, based on what's been going on currently, rates have been going up substantially. And I'll go back to mid-December. Rates to the West Coast skyrocketed because carriers just did not want to go because there was no produce coming back. And truckload rates generally in the $4,000 range from the Midwest doubled to $8,000 to $9,000 for the same load. So that supply and demand thing and everything affected the rates drastically. Currently, rates are being affected by diesel fuels going up in price every week. We're averaging about $3.28 a gallon this week. Every time the national average put out by the feds on Monday reports goes up, the invoice rates go up because their fuel surcharges are added to freight invoices. So it increases your cost of transportation, which basically increases your cost of the final product because it increases your cost to transport the goods. So from a rate standpoint, we've only seen a considerable amount of uptrend to the cost of transportation. One of the reasons is a lot of truckers have gotten out of the business. It is really an older person's occupation, and when ELDs came into effect, a lot of drivers were not tech savvy, or they didn't want the intrusion of the government putting ELDs in their own tractors or personal vehicles. Mm-hmm. And what ELDs also does is it has a GPS tracker, which allows pretty much anyone who has access to track exactly where that person is at all times, 24/7. it caused a number of drivers to get out of the business, which caused less drivers, which caused rates to go up because you had to pay more to the drivers that stayed in the business. And the drivers that are staying in the business with fuel prices or updating their equipment, those trucks are now $160,000 and trailers are $70,000. So a driver who's an owner-operator has got a $250,000 investment. So that's why rates are going up. Shortage of drivers, drivers getting out of the business, buying, and the cost of electronic machines that go in the tractors, and increased in fuel costs.
Wow, so there's a lot of different elements playing into that. What do you think, well, the end consumer will ultimately see of this, an increase at the end that they'll see? Is that correct?
I think the spikes have already occurred, but you're going to see a small gradual increase continuing over the years to come. But, we saw a 16 to 20% increase back in December, and that's only going to continue as fuel costs rise. But it provides better service. It provides more tracking ability of the freight that's on the trailers. So there's positives, but it also is requiring rate increases and higher wages for drivers to be able to hire drivers to transport the goods and so on.
Okay. Wow. And then talking summer, it finally feels like summer is here with the weather.
Certainly.
Which is great. But summer highway safety, take us through what issues come up with more motorists on the roads in the summer. What do you see?
Yeah, it's like this weekend, being a Memorial Day weekend, much more traffic out there. You've got the families now where school's ending and they're going on vacations. You've got cities like, for instance, we're in the Midwest. They do most of their construction spring, summer, and fall. And you've got construction zones out there that are slowing double lanes to single lanes and slowing down traffic at construction zones. Also, the warmer weather, it's harder on equipment. You're running air conditioners. You're running APU units to keep your tractors refrigerated when you're sitting idle. You've got to deal with tires are more apt to be wear faster in a warmer environment going down the highway. If you got an external temperature of 90 degrees, sometimes the highways are 120 to 132, and those tires have a tendency to wear much more in hotter, warmer areas. So, in essence, it takes a truck a lot longer to go from point A to point B when you're dealing with 30, 40% more traffic, construction zones, warmer temperatures, and it's just it slows down the process of the tractors from going across the country only because the roads are more populated and more obstacles to deal with on a day-to-day basis. So a lot of our trucks like to run in the evenings where tourists are usually off the roads and construction zones are idle for the night and cooler temperatures. So you'll see a lot more transportation of the tractor-trailer in the evenings during the summer months for a number of reasons.
Wow. This is really interesting. So much more than,
sounds like you can't catch a break. It's like you have the snowstorms in the winter. You have the roads that are too hot in the summer. You probably have like a two-month sweet spot, in October and April.
Do we have a few more minutes? I'd like to touch on one topic.
Oh, please.
We as Cannonball Express, we run basically owner-operators, which means the driver owns their truck, they own their trailer, and they're a contractor. A lot of your national trucking companies, and this isn't positive or negative, but they're employee drivers. They get paid by the mile. They don't own the truck. They don't own the trailer. They don't have an investment in the equipment. So basically, you see a lot of the national companies running with teams, two guys in a tractor, and they can work each 14-hour stretches and drive up to 11 hours. When you're an owner-operator and you're delivering freight like food items like Heritage, you might have 8 or 10 stops, and you've got a single driver in his own truck and his own trailer with $250,000 investment, and he only earns money if he can be moving down the road and making deliveries. So there's a difference between an owner-operator, which is really a dying breed because you don't have people that can invest $250,000 in a truck and trailer and be their own boss. So a lot of drivers now are becoming national trucking company employees, which allows them to be paid by the mile. So you're really losing the breed of the owner-operator because of the cost to stay in the business as a contractor and an independent operator. So there are really, in my mind, two different types of trucking companies and drivers. You got owner-operators and you got employee drivers, and it's a way different scenario on how you make a living based on which one you are.
You know, Larry, we like the rare breeds at Heritage, so it sounds like we work like with the rare breed. Yes. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, but it is a dying breed. I've been in the business for 43 years, and owner-operators are fabulous people, and it's just a blessing to have so many committed drivers, but again, they're in the older age range bracket, and I see a lot of that going away, mainly because of the cost. The national drivers, they say nowadays, with the raising costs of transportation, if you're shipping over 600 miles, it's cheaper to put it on a rail. So you're seeing the longer loads going on piggybacks on the trains. But you can't do that with Heritage-type products when you're shipping one or two pallet orders on a 12-stop trailer. Mm-hmm. The option to piggyback on a train is not there. So your costs are still going to be on the road and not being able to save by going on a train to go across the country, like a lot of national carriers are able to do. So,
well, Larry, on behalf of all of us at Heritage Foods and all of our chefs and restaurants and charcuterie makers that you guys deliver to on our behalf every week, thank you for all that you do. And
you're welcome.
We truly couldn't get it there without you guys.
Yeah, you guys are the silent movers behind it all.
No doubt. This country was built on the backs of truck drivers.
For sure. Well, thank you so much, Larry. We enjoyed having you on, and this is insightful. Things I think you guys really are the silent movers, maybe not getting all the acclaim that you should be. So I was so happy
learning.
We
need to make another convoy movie. It's time.
C.W. McCall, well, you have a great and safe Memorial Day weekend, and thank you for you let me to contribute to your radio and your customers.
That's a big 10-4. I'm so glad I got to say that.
Thank you, Larry.
Watch the Smokies in the woods. All right,
bye-bye. Bye, Larry. And with that, thank you all for listening. We have a great show next week with some more pressing topics in the food industry that we're going to bring up. And make sure to tune in next is Tech Bites at 11 a.m. And from all of us here, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Going with me riding all around town for joy. Now you're home.